Game on 2FM.
With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein your way.
Thanks to Jenny Green for her entertainment for the last couple of hours. It's Tuesday the 20th of April and this is Game On.
Coming up today, Mark Langdon has the latest on the Super League fallout as Pep Guardiola has his say.
If you ask me, it's about these teams have been selected. I don't know the reason why. And a sport is not a sport when the relation between the effort and the success, the effort and reward don't exist. So it's not a sport.
Ireland's Cliona Maloney is with us to take stock on a roller coaster Six Nations so far.
Ireland go to the front. It's a clever, quick one. And Friday's taking it. Ireland now with the ball and trying to push their way towards that French line. Dane Hattie to let the pack continue. France struggling to contain it. They're over the line. Can they get down? Yes, they can. Cliona Maloney strikes back for Ireland.
And Brendan Devaney brings us to Ulster football draw. There's League of Ireland action. And we have the latest as two Irish swimmers qualify for Tokyo.
Game on 2FM.
If you want to get in touch, please do so on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Now, I mentioned yesterday evening as I rushed out the door that I was trying to get home to watch the Liverpool-Leeds game, and being honest, it wasn't for the football. It was more for the build-up and the reaction afterwards to this new proposed European Super League, which is what everybody's talking about at the moment. And I have to say, last night's television on Sky didn't disappoint. It was box office television. We got the views of some of the biggest names in the game and they absolutely didn't hold back. There was a nice spat between Jurgen Klopp and Gary Neville, and we got to hear James Milner's thoughts and Patrick Bamford's, and you don't always get to hear from players, but it was just really good television. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was. I thought it was possibly facilitated a little bit though by Sky, because when you think about it, the Premier League is the biggest action that Sky Sports have. So I thought they definitely let it run and let it be. They don't have to be impartial, but they were definitely letting it run.
And that was a good thing, as you mentioned, by Bamford and Milner, Marie, that they got off the fence. I think their players in it, and you could hear every PR officer saying to them, you know, kick the touch and just, you know, a club will make the statement. But for them to come out and get off the fence, I thought was good. I think Ruby's right. The lads are probably, you know, in a position where Sky, you know, look after their contracts, whereas the two lads, I think we're speaking on behalf of everyone that's involved in the sport.
Yeah, I think the Sky thing is obviously a big issue, and given the platform that it was on and that we all pay so much to watch it, and it has been guilty of pricing people out of football, there is an issue with that. But at the same time, you don't get television like that very often, and I just found myself absolutely glued to the analysis of it. I actually compared it to, it was almost like Liveline from football fans, because it did feel like they were saying a lot of what I was thinking and a lot of what...
Talk to Gary.
Pretty much people that I knew were thinking as well. So, yeah, it was great. And look, even, you know, you don't... There was the little, I suppose, the personal interaction between Klopp and Gary Neville, and you don't get that anymore. Everything is so sanitised that very rare that people have a pop at each other or even are given a platform to have an immediate pop back, which was just great.
Yeah, and he still is grown, to be fair to him, Gary Neville, and even just speaking about, you know, the employment he's created in the area, that you wouldn't do stuff like that without telling the people that are working for you. You wouldn't make announcements without leaving people that work for you know. So I thought he had an interesting take on it, and
A lot of people were critical of Klopp as well for kind of getting personal with Gary Neville. But I liked it because, you know, he's going to get on the bus and say exactly probably what he said on the television to his players, or go home and talk to his family and be given out about Gary Neville. So I was glad that he just went straight out and said exactly what he was thinking, even if it was personal.
Yeah, you hardly thought Jurgen Klopp was going to be afraid of Gary Neville, though, did you?
I didn't think he'd have a pop at him from a professional point of view. I thought he'd more direct his anger to the situation that his owners have put him in, because he's the one that is out front and centre talking about Liverpool. But I liked that he got a bit personal.
The thing for me that I'm shocked with is the emotional involvement out of everyone in it. You know, the way you think it's, you know, the players, ex-players as well, that are, they're a bit away from it. But Carragher and Neville last night, you know, there was nearly a truce between two massive rivals to just say how wrong it is, or well, how wrong they feel it is.
They have such a romantic association with football. It's been such a big part of their life, and like clearly it's given them a lot of enjoyment and careers and money and set them up financially. But it's also probably everything that they talk about, everything that they do, everything that their family is involved in. They've been raised on it, and they just don't want it to change.
Yeah, but both probably came into soccer just around the time money came into it. They didn't aspire to be soccer players when they were earning the wages soccer players earn now. Like, they did obviously always get better paid than some people, but you got to look back. It was Robbie Fowler, Steve McManaman, Jamie Carragher. That was
they're
that
all
era.
Still working,
that,
Ruby.
Yeah, but that was the first era. That
but I mean,
got
as
into,
in they aren't the people that earned the millions and billions.
No,
they still have to go out and work.
They started with a love for playing football, but it was never about the money for them. So I can understand where their passion came from.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, even Gary Neville speaking about how he nearly had to fight every day to be picked by Alex Ferguson. You know, just on that point, Marie, that, you know, they scrapped to make it.
Yeah, no, it was good, I have to say. Now, as I said as well, it is not going anywhere. It has been evolving all day. We're getting so much reaction from it, from the royals to pop stars to players to managers to owners to Amazon Prime to politicians. Everyone is coming out now giving their two cents on it. And to bring us up to speed, Mark Langdon of the Racing Post joins us now. Mark, there has been a lot of, I wouldn't say developments, but definitely a lot of reaction, and people are just voicing their opinions and concerns. But one that probably has a lot of people interested is the government's getting involved, and particularly the British government and Boris Johnson coming out very strongly and saying that he is prepared to introduce new legislation to prevent the formation of this Super League, and also suggesting that there might be an issue with work permits as well. Do you think these are things that can stack up?
I don't know if I trust the British government to get too much right at the moment. So I think it's right that government are trying to get involved, because I think this goes beyond sort of football and beyond sport, really, what they're trying to do, the problems it would create, run much deeper. So I'm not surprised that government potentially will get involved. If you think of the business aspects of sport, I think it's probably wrong that they've not had as much involvement previously, actually. And if you go back to sort of, you were talking earlier there about Gary Neville, it's something that Gary Neville has been calling for quite some time, to have somebody regulating sort of football and the Premier League. So I'm not surprised that the government are getting involved. Whether they're able to stop this juggernaut, I wouldn't be as confident about. I think that if this gets stopped, it will be just down to the sheer anger of football teams, of football supporters, even those, of course, that are sort of represented by the clubs that have tried to break away. I think we've already had sort of this afternoon a couple of teams maybe briefing off the record, a couple of the 12 teams that they didn't necessarily want to be part of it, and potentially backtracking already, which would be a huge embarrassment. We've had also UEFA announce in the last hour or so that they believe that they can get a lot more money investment for future Champions Leagues, and that they're prepared to run a direct rival against the European Super League. So it's developing all the time. I think that in terms of government, I'm not surprised they're getting involved. Whether they be the ones to stop it, I'm not so sure.
But Mark, there probably is the crux of the argument. UEFA, when their backs are to the wall, are maintaining they can get more money for the Champions League, but that's what these clubs wanted all along. And you listen to, we discuss it regularly on this show when we're talking to you about European soccer, like in what kind of a financial crisis Real Madrid are in, Barcelona are in. I mean, we had Florentino Perez out today saying that this was to save football. Are UEFA and the Champions League taking too big a cut, and those teams want more?
I think that there is a fair point and a fair argument to be made that, UEFA are definitely not the good guys in all of this, and they're far from perfect themselves. Now, that's not to say that I agree with a European sort of breakaway, and I sort of echo the thoughts of most people on sort of the general opinion of what these 12 teams have tried to do. But I think that they felt they had no choice, because UEFA were in their opinion having too much control, and were not offering as good a service as what they possibly could. And I think that there are definite reasons for thinking that. I don't think the Champions League is as good as it could be. If you look at the group stage of the Champions League, it is in serious need of a revamp, and they have tried to do that on Monday, and this was sort of part of the announcement from the Sunday. The UEFA announced, you know, that they're going to go up to 36 teams in the group stage. There's going to be 10 fixtures. You'll play 5 at home, 5 away against completely different teams, and it would be done on sort of what they call a Swiss system of points, and it depended where you finished in the overall league as to whether you qualified directly for the last 16 or had to play off for a spot in the knockout stages. And I think they've made a mess of that, and I don't think they have tapped into the money available. And you could argue, and I think that the big clubs have argued, that they probably do deserve more money of that Champions League pot, and that it's not distributed right, and they've not sold it for as much money as they possibly could. And they would probably argue that the only way to have got UEFA to have listened to those complaints would have been have done this breakaway, and they've been threatening it for a long while. I do think, and I do wonder though, if they've overplayed their hand slightly here, because given the negative reaction, it's always been, the big clubs have always said, if you don't give us what we want, we're going to form this new Super League. If there isn't the appetite for this Super League, they haven't really got anything else to play. So I think it'll be fascinating to see where this one runs out. But definitely UEFA are not perfect, and they probably could have done more in terms of, you know, getting more for the Champions League.
On the point of overplaying their hand, it does feel kind of as the time goes on, even just the hours, and more people are reacting to it, that their power is eroding a little bit, because when they have clubs like PSG and Bayern Munich, two super clubs, coming out saying that they don't want to be part of it, and then you have the likes of Jordan Henderson calling all the captains together to try and figure out what they want, it does feel that things are starting to erode just a little bit, Mark.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, Marcus Rashford has come out and tweeted about how football's for the fans. So it wasn't a direct sort of, I don't want the Super League. But if you read between the lines, that was pretty clear. Pep Guardiola says, you know, he doesn't want it, doesn't believe in it. Jurgen Klopp said the same. There aren't many people outside of those 12 owners that do think it's a good idea. And I do think that, even they will have expected a certain amount of negativity, there's no doubt about that, and they would have known it would have caused a furore, but maybe even it's caught them by surprise with just how aggressive it has been. And it does feel like this is a really pivotal moment here, because they'll be hoping to ride it out over the next couple of weeks and maybe the next month or so, but I sense the pressure is too great. And absolutely right, I mean, a European Super League without Neymar and Mbappe and without Bayern Munich, it doesn't feel as super as what it could be. What you would say just against that though is that maybe Paris Saint-Germain's reasons for not signing up again, sort of, it's not because they believe in the good of the game necessarily. Paris Saint-Germain's owners are very close and tight to UEFA when it comes to TV rights, so you know, that relationship there would have been broken had Paris Saint-Germain decided to sign up. So I'm not putting them down as the good guys either in all of this. Bayern Munich maybe more so. It's difficult for German teams to go into any kind of change because of the fan ownership that is throughout the Bundesliga, with the exception of one or two clubs, and that's something I think that, you know, English teams have lost over the years, and maybe the supporters, I've got a little bit to blame themselves. I mean, has there been enough complaints over all of the foreign ownership that's come in? They've happily accepted all of these fantastic players that they brought in, and with that, they've lost control over, you know, possibly the destiny of their own club and ticket prices and all kinds of other things. So, you know, having these wealthy and rich owners isn't necessarily all that it's cracked up to be.
And Mark, could that also add into, I have no idea what a Premier League soccer player's contract looks like, but can Jordan Henderson and Marcus Rashford say they oppose this, but ultimately will they have to play in it?
Oh, no, I don't know what's in the finer details. I would be surprised if there was anything in there that enabled them to sort of, to walk away or to, to not play in it. What they could do is, you know, if they really opposed it that much, they could ask for a transfer, refuse to play, and then go and play, for a team that's not involved in the European Super League. The cynic in me wonders it, you know, if you put another zero on the end of all of the contracts, whether the players would be, as against
the point I was trying to get at.
Yeah.
Very easy to tweet it and say it, but then actually go and do it.
Exactly. I think Marcus Rashford and Jordan Henderson actually, I mean, maybe being unfair to them too, individually, because I think they have shown real social awareness over, off-field issues over the last year or so. And, maybe I'm being really unfair to put them in that bracket, but I would say that there would be enough, players out there that would, accept that and sort of all the hate that comes with it, if it meant an extra zero on the contract.
And me too, not against those two players in particular. If you think what Marcus Rashford did with all the lunches and dinners in England, was incredible.
And Henderson in the NHS. And,
yeah, exactly. So not those two in particular, but you just wonder what, when it comes down to pounds, shilling and pence, what'll happen.
There are plenty of them that come to mind, and that's for sure. Yeah. Donica's actually raising his hand here. He's wondering, gone. Would Good he be luck. Able to go back and change career and be a soccer player? But the players, in fairness, they're doing what they can. We saw Leeds last night wearing the T-shirts. The Independent is reporting now that the 14 Premier League clubs who've not signed up for the Super League are going to follow in Leeds' footsteps, and they're going to wear the T-shirts speaking out against this proposal. Chelsea are hosting Brighton tonight, so it'll be interesting to see if anyone is wearing the T-shirts there. But like Mark, you'd have to imagine, just given the welcome that Liverpool players got last night, that is something that could escalate as things progress and as people have time to start planning, with matches coming as well.
Yeah, I would have thought so. And, you know, it's not just when they play away from home. I mean, you wonder what sort of reception these teams will get the next time they're at home outside the stadium, because nobody's angrier with these teams than their own supporters at this point, because particularly for clubs that are seen, and Liverpool would be one, and I think Manchester United another, and it's something that Carragher and Neville mentioned sort of last night, that social awareness of, you know, what you represent. You're going against that, and you're going against virtually all the beliefs of the last 100 and however many years it is, on something that really nobody wants outside of these sort of 12 business people. I think it does a disservice to supporters around the world, and there will of course be some that would rather watch Real Madrid against Juventus, but you know, there's a lot of people that take up the foreign rights that absolutely love the Premier League or love La Liga, and they, most of them, you can't speak for all of them obviously, but most of them are angry as well. They don't want to see it. You know, you're always going to get some that would like this kind of NFL style, but I mean, you're talking about a small minority, I would say, of football fans around the globe that would sacrifice the sort of domestic league that you've got, but also the Champions League, because the Champions League is the best of the best once you get to the knockout stages. That Bayern Munich versus Paris game the other week, the two legs were absolutely fantastic. You go to Liverpool against Barcelona and Tottenham v Ajax and all of those great Champions League moments. But one of the reasons they're so fantastic is because they don't play each other on a regular basis like you'd get in the Premier League, and it would become mundane within a year. It would, you know, you don't want to necessarily need to see Real Madrid against Liverpool five times a year. You know, you once or twice every now and then is absolutely perfect. And I think that would be the same in the US. I think, in the Asian markets, you know, these teams have still got sort of loyal and supporters that understand the game. I think it's unfair to label those around the world as, you know, being stupid and foolish and not quite getting it. I think most of them do.
Mark, when is the next key decision, or do we have to wait for each club individually to make their stance on it?
Yeah, I don't think there is sort of like a calendar or a timestamp of when the next big moments will be. It's just it'll just keep on drip feeding. You wait for our meeting on Friday, but that's 3 days away, so a lot could happen before then. And there were some suggestions from the Danish representative, who was reckoning that the teams that have accepted this could be thrown out of the Champions League and the Europa League this season. And he referenced a meeting between the UEFA delegates on Friday to decide what happens next. If Friday feels like a long way away, really, from where we've moved from Sunday to today, I have no idea what position we'll be in discussing next on Friday, but that's certainly when UEFA are due to meet.
And Mark, when you heard all the calls from different people wanting the six teams in the Premier League to have points deducted, etc., but if you chuck those six out of the Premier League, what are you left with?
Yeah, you're not left with the product that that TV companies will be paying the same kind of money for. What I would say is, what are you left with if them six teams are in it, but they're also in this Super League? Because the Super League proposes 18 matches in their league season before a knockout series of that involves eight teams. That would be at least 18 matches, and in excess of 20 for those that sort of go far in a European Super League. You're going to be playing B teams in the Premier League, particularly if it doesn't matter whether you qualify for Europe. If Liverpool have got Real Madrid on the Tuesday, they're not going to pick their best team against Burnley on the Saturday. It doesn't matter if they finish second or 17th in the Premier League. So, I don't think you're left with much of a product either way if the Super League goes ahead. And that's why it's so important. You've either got the 20 Premier League teams, but, six of them are not bothered, or you haven't got them at all, and I'm not sure what the better of those two situations is. It's probably to not have them at all, and then you just hope you create a dramatic end to the season with teams that are much more competitive against each other. But in time, you would still get a hierarchy there, wouldn't you? And you'd end up with a next big six as well. So I think it's probably just about better with them, and playing their B teams. But of course, that is, I think, the crux of this issue, really, that if a European Super League comes in, it doesn't really matter whether the teams are kicked out of the Premier League or not, that the product, the domestic week-by-week product, will be so much worse that it doesn't really bear thinking about.
There are lots of texts flying in, as to be expected, because this is quite an emotive issue. Val from Ballyshannon says, at the end of the day, we all know it's all about money. UEFA and FIFA are no angels, but they are both money grabbers, and Sky TV are crying because they're afraid of losing big money. This is a criticism for all of us. Utterly how hilarious it is how clueless you all are on player motivation. For 95% of players, it's their passion for the game. Money wouldn't change their views on it at all. Clueless. Now, we did say that only a certain percentage would be motivated by money. And I'm going to follow it up then with James Doherty from Letterkenny. His text, which says, Real Madrid saying they're nearly bankrupt, yet playing Gareth Bale $600,000 a week to play golf. I'd say Gareth Bale were probably one of the people that would like to play in it. It is hard to have sympathy for Real Madrid, though, really, when they're talking about being close to bankruptcy. Yet at the same time, you're looking at some of their decisions and some of their wages, Mark, and thinking you probably should have made better choices.
Yeah, I mean, Gareth Bale, a good example there, because he was quite happy to go to China, sort of when Real Madrid were trying to get rid of him before. He wasn't that bothered about sort of the level that he was playing at, as long as somebody was prepared to pay, him high enough wage. And, I suspect that there are a lot of players like that, and I suppose is their right. If somebody wants to pay somebody £600,000 a week, you're not going to say no to that. In terms of Real Madrid, they have made a lot of bad decisions, and this goes for all the teams that haven't got to pay these players these wages. This is what it seems to be about, and Perez was complaining about the costs, and Barcelona have done this as well. You haven't got you haven't got a sort of God-given right to have these super superstar players. If you can't afford them, then you have to go for players that you can, or you have to go to your youth system and you have to trust your coaches to be able to develop your own talent. You know, it's quite bizarre that, these sort of super clubs are bemoaning the wages that they've happily paid for these players. The pandemic, of course, has really sped up this process, particularly, I would say that the Spanish teams are in a big state at the moment, and Real Madrid are in the process of trying to build a new stadium, probably the worst possible time to do it. But yeah, they don't need to have all of these players. You look at the young, you know, stars that they've sold. Reguilón went to Tottenham. Hakimi went to Inter. Llorente was signed to Atletico Madrid. You know, they could have kept them players, developed them, and, you know, sold some of the more high profile players. They didn't need to buy Eden Hazard. They just felt like that they should. And you know, Barcelona didn't need to spend 120 million euros on Philippe Coutinho and then loan him out to Bayern Munich. So the clubs have really only got themselves to blame, because, you know, the players are going to take the money if it's offered.
Absolutely. And just before we finish up, Mark, do you think this is going to happen?
I would go for no, because I still think that it's just too difficult to see how it can work and where the support is for it. What I do think will happen is that UEFA eventually will have to crack and make a bigger Champions League that maybe involves more teams than it currently does, and that kind of is where the settlement sort of goes. And I certainly hope it doesn't happen, and I'd be confident enough that it won't.
Okay, Mark Langdon of the Racing Post, thanks so much for joining us. We're going to take a very quick break, and then Cliona Maloney is with us to talk rugby.
The all-new Rainbow Cup kicks off this weekend with an age-old rivalry when Connacht travel to the Kingspan Stadium to take on Interpro rivals Ulster. It's all live here on Game On this Friday from 7:30. Is there gold at the end of the Rainbow Cup? We'll soon see here on 2FM Game On. 2FM.
Welcome back. So the Rainbow Cup, Dunners, it is coming up and it is going to be live here on Game on Friday evening. But unfortunately, it isn't the competition that we were expecting it to be.
Yeah, look, I think COVID has probably stopped people travelling like we would have liked. The South African teams will struggle to probably get over. So it's going to be kind of run off at the moment with an Interpro to start. So three Interpros, which will be interesting. The main thing to take from it, Marie, is there's a few rule changes. So looking forward
Hang
to seeing
it. Hang on, Ruby, listening. Rules. Come on, your favourite
I
thing.
Oh, yeah. I'm listening. I hope Eddie Jones is listening.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's been looking into a few of them. So there's going to be the captain's challenge. So a captain will be allowed to challenge everything in a certain way and everything within the last 5 minutes of a game. I'm not too sure about that one. The red card, this one I'm disappointed with, just with the current rulings of the game at the moment. I think if we're trying to change players' behaviour to bring a yellow or a red card down to 20 minutes, obviously the player can't return. The player that's sent off can't return, but you can replace them with a sub on after 20 minutes. So when Peter Omani was red carded against Wales, we would have been allowed to bring someone on after 20 minutes. I can understand it for the game in terms of as soon as you get a red card in rugby, it's over. But I just think if we want to change behaviour, especially when it comes to tackle height and head safety, I think we need to just probably stay within it for a little bit longer. And the other one is if you're held up over the in-goal, that you get a dropout. So probably the one that I was most interested was a 50-20, the new way of kicking. If you kick in your half and it bounces, you get the line out in the 22. I thought that would have encouraged teams to keep three in the backfield and give them more room to attack. I would like to have seen that one come in, but yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
Challenge everything. Challenge what, like? I'm sorry, the captain's challenge.
Yeah, the captain's...
What's he going to challenge? It's my laid out, not yours.
Well, even small things, Ruby. Was there a forward pass in the build-up to that? But I just find it ridiculous. Like, how far back do you go? You know what I mean? Or when can you play it? I understand...
Back to half-time.
I understand the challenge in tennis. It makes complete sense and it can be done really quickly. But, you know, players on the pitch, I just think it's messy and we should just actually be supporting the referees.
Can we have a water break? Can we send someone in to tell them what the challenge about?
You can rest assured there will be some ways of getting signs on to players on the pitch, be it water carriers coming on or people holding up certain things in the on the... I remember we used to play against the Ospreys and they would hold up a massive pad for certain calls and things like that. So there'll be a bit of people being creative. Look, it's... you want the sport to evolve and you want to find ways, and the only thing we'll find out by is trialling things, and we've seen them in New Zealand and they've been good. I'll be
what
honest
was the one you loved again every Monday you were talking about it,
the 50-20?
No, the buzzer.
Oh, the buzzer,
the golden buzzer.
I think that was on the X Factor, was it? Oh yeah, it was golden point, Marie. So just when you like played an extra time and next score wins. It was just, I thought it was great.
That would have been a good
never
one.
Knew you're an X Factor, never knew you were an X Factor fan, Marie.
I knew it was golden something. Anyway, enough about the Rainbow Cup. We'll be talking about it over the next few days because it is live here on Game on Friday evening. I'm delighted to say that we have an actual rugby player now on the line, a current one who might be able to give her views on the new rules. Cliona Maloney, how are you?
I'm very well, Marie. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us. We were just chatting a little bit about the new rules that are coming in for the Rainbow Cup. As someone who is currently playing the game, do you have any thoughts on them?
I mean, it's interesting for sure, and it definitely takes a lot of getting used to. We played the most recent season over here in the Allianz Premier 15s. We've had adapted rules due to COVID. Before we were getting PCR tested, we were playing... Well, we've had to finish out the whole season in the new rules now, but we've been playing with, you know, less scrums and reduced time to 70 minutes, which has given us a lot more ball and play time. So it certainly is a different game, and it definitely has an impact on results, because as we've seen over here, you know, you've had teams like Exeter taking Saracens and Harlequins, and you've had a couple of surprise shock defeats of the bigger, traditionally stronger teams in that way, because I guess, you know, you're taking away their superpower, which is their scrum and line-out, and you can only maul inside the 22. It's also another rule that we've been brought in over here just for COVID restrictions. But it would definitely have a huge impact on the game, so it's interesting to see how it would have an impact on the Rainbow Cup as well.
Cliona, just on that, just tell us in terms of fatigue factors for front five forwards, how does that transfer with the work from scrummaging and mauling compared to ball and play time?
Yeah, it's huge, and that's been one of the most evident things. Like, I guess you would see kind of maybe some of the larger, heavier props or whatever struggling to kind of get around, come later on in the game. You might be making substitutions at half time if they are a more scrum specialist front row, I suppose, rather than a loose front row. But yeah, it's definitely made us look at the game differently here. Now, I know Giselle Mather, our head coach, she absolutely loves it because she's got no time for giving us scrum and line-out time of training anyway. She's back all day, so she's delighted. But I know a couple of the props are crying. They'd love more scrums. But I think we are planning on going back to normal next year, but it definitely gives you a different perspective on the game for sure.
Poor old Dunners is just heartbroken that somebody's into wanting backs to play rugby and not the forwards. He just can't
just
cope with this, Cliona.
It's just a boxing mentality. Just keep the ball alive.
Cliona, it's been a tough week for you, I'd imagine, so far. Obviously, a great start against Wales, and then France was a bit of a, I suppose, a kind of back down to earth almost, because it was a defeat that nobody was expecting, really. How have you been dealing with it in the aftermath?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we weren't getting carried away with ourselves after Wales. We knew, no disrespect to them, but, you know, they're in a bit of a transition period. They've got a new coach, and they've had a lot of changes in their squad recently, so... They would admit that themselves. They're in a bit of a transition period, but they've already qualified for the upcoming World Cup, so they're comfortable in that building phase, I guess, where we still have to qualify, as do Italy. I guess in terms of that, we needed to be realistic about how we won and the opportunities we left behind after Wales. You know, we did win convincingly, but we did leave a lot behind, and we still made a lot of mistakes there. And then I guess you move forward and you look to France, and it was difficult. It was certainly difficult the last 2 days. You know, after the game, you're doing your hot review, you're doing your cold review, and it's pretty much you're in a dark, dark cave. I guess it's difficult for anyone to try to talk to you and stuff when you're in that process. But I think we're kind of coming around now as a team. We've realised what actually did happen, which is that, you know, let's be honest, we didn't execute our game plan against France, and they capitalised off all of our errors. Our ill-disciplined penalty try, we had yellow cards. We coughed up possession twice and they scored straight off that from midfield, you know, turnover ball in rucks. lots of stuff. We couldn't problem solve at scrum time. You know, it's all self-inflicted, if I'm going to be brutally honest with you. So in one sense, that's very bad. In another sense, that's actually, it's not the worst thing in the world because we know we can fix it. And to be quite honest, we'd love to have a hop off them again this weekend because I think we know ourselves we didn't show our best account last weekend. And we're not as big as the win was blowing us up to be, and we're not as small as the loss was deeming us to be either. You know, it's a balance of both, I guess. But we need to be playing that top quality opposition, you know, more often. We need to be under pressure to perform and make decisions around our set piece and our defence more often against world class players like France and like England. And unfortunately, because there's been no club rugby in Ireland, you know, a lot of our players haven't had that decision making process. They haven't had that in game moment. They haven't been, you know, tested week in, week out, every Saturday playing club rugby or playing whatever it is. We've only had the camps, and there's only so much, as the boys will know, that you can get out of training. You need to be challenged in a proper game scenario against people who don't know your structures and you don't know their structures. So, yeah, a bit of realism, I guess, is needed to look at the win and the loss, and just our focus is now firmly on beating Italy. I mean, they've got a lot of the same aspirations as us this year. You know, they want to put a stamp on the Six Nations. They want to finish third. They want to qualify for the World Cup. And they want to, you know, have a really big 18 months leading into the World Cup, which is now next year in New Zealand.
Cliona, you were saying there about there's only so much work you can do in training. It's the mental sharpness that I found as a jockey you lacked. Maybe you find it as rugby players. You can't recreate live, unorganised situations, and it's that mental sharpness that you only get from participation. Is that what you're missing?
100%. Look, it's whatever you want to call it, championship ready. You know, you need to be ready to go. You need to be making decisions in the moment. You need to be dealing with calls that you might think the referee has made that are unfair. You need to be problem solving scrum time. You need to be reacting to what they're doing in line out defence. And there's only so many times you can recreate that in training when it's not predictable. You know what I mean? You're playing against your own teammates, so they're going to present pictures that you're used to. You're going to be tackling people that you're used to tackling. You're going to be, you know, we've brought in referees and stuff like that into camp, but we really just need matches. And the girls in Ireland need matches. And there's nothing that could have been done about it this year, to be fair. The government restrictions are the government restrictions. And unfortunately, in France and England, well, fortunately for me and the girls who are able to play, but, you know, we have had rugby and the girls at home haven't. They've just been training. So that is, you know, it's a mixture of both. You know, we still do have exceptional talent, and the girls are still as good as everyone believed, you know, they were after Wales. That's not the case at all. It's just that, you know, we really lacked pressure. Performance under pressure is really what we lacked against France.
Like, the situation we were all in this year was a situation we were in. But going forward, what can be done about it?
I guess going forward, we just need more test games. And it's hard to know what the AIL would have looked like this year. You know, I can't comment too much on, they had investment planned. But I don't know into what extent that investment, or, you know, what the AIL would have looked like this year had it gone ahead. So it's very hard to comment on where that's at the moment. I know there was just planned for it. But there does need to be investment into the grassroots. There needs to be investment into the senior women's AIL and also the interprovincials. It's been mentioned a lot today in people in the media that I've been talking to. They've asked about, you know, what's the possibility of having a European club championship in the women's game, or what's the possibility of having a Lions tournament. I think really we need to look at the club structures in all of the, in all of the nations first of all, before we can get to a Lions. I think we should probably look at having a European championship of some sort, because we need the best in Ireland to be playing the best in England and the best in France, and that's probably where we will make the most ground. And obviously we need a good AIL structure too to back that up and to feed into that. Currently we just don't have the player pool at that level that there is here in England and that there obviously is in France.
Cliona, you see it in Wasps. Do you think that's a system or a structure that would be easily put in place in Ireland? Like, 100% we want AIL because that gets participation, but you're saying we need it at all different levels for everyone, even, you know, at test level with the talks at WXV. That's important as well to get in place.
100%. Look, there's a lot of stuff been thrown around since the France game about it's just professionalism. It's not just professionalism. You know, that is one aspect of it. Of course, you know, the national team, if they want to compete with the top five in the world, they have to be professional. And like, I won't get in trouble for saying that, because that's just a cold hard fact. That's how it is. You know, the professionalism is already in the game. There's no turning back now. but you've got to look from the bottom up. So there's got to be more participation. There's got to be more accessibility all around the country. In every walk of life, you know, a child, particularly a girl, should have access to rugby. And right throughout rural Ireland, right throughout urban Ireland, disadvantaged Ireland, everything. Then you move up from that, and there's got to be a really competitive, good AIL club structure with really good club coaches who are involved. And then you move up from that again, and at interprovincial level, you know, we've seen an improvement there already where they've had more fixtures. You know, they each play each other twice. But even still, that's not good enough. You know, we've got to increase that to potentially playing, you know, some kind of European championship. But that's out of Ireland's hands, I guess. You know, that's up to European rugby or world rugby or whoever it might be to implement that competition and get that underway. There's been talk about it for a couple of years now, but I don't see anything in fruition yet. Well, I think those things are all really important for creating a big player pool. And then essentially, obviously, professionalism is, it is already in the women's game, and there's no turning away from it now. You know, like, the top teams in the world are professional, and if they're not professional, they're part-time professional. But like, I've seen the setup in Marcoussis in France, and it is amazing. And I've seen how the girls trained over there. We went on a training weekend or training week with them. I think it was October 2019, essentially. And you know, they are very professional in what they do, and they have players in there all the time. With the fluidity between their sevens and their 15 squad, they've almost got a full two teams to play against each other all of the time and to train against each other. So, you know, there's lots of developments to be made, but it's got to be a holistic approach. It can't just be one or the other.
Cliona, the issue that I have with this is that it's a conversation that I have heard many times since the Ireland women's team won that Grand Slam with the likes of Lynn and Fiona. And yet here we are, probably coming up close to a decade now on. And those structures that you're talking about, which sound pretty basic and sound like they should already be in, are not in yet. Do you have confidence in the union, in the society, in the values of the game, really, that it is going to happen, that they are going to be put in? And it's not a big ask, but it is essential for the development of the game, so that we have 15 players going out representing our country who are well capable of participating and competing and winning at the top level week after week after year after year.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, it is not acceptable. And that's part of what this campaign, this Never Settle campaign is about. You know, it's not only about the players not settling for reduced media coverage or reduced access to this or that or the other. It's about the public demanding more. It's about the public demanding more so that we do have a really competitive rugby culture in Ireland, in women and in men. You know, it's got to be everything. It's got to be everyone buying in and demanding more of the government, demanding more of the RFU, whoever it is. You know, we can't settle for what we have at the minute, because it's clearly not good enough. We're doing the best with what we have. But there needs to be more. There needs to be more investment. There needs to be more demand. There needs to be more people playing the game. There needs to be more accessibility in schools and in clubs all around the country. And it all needs to move on now.
Yeah, absolutely. They are the important steps. And Clint, I've been there before. It's really hard the week after a loss like that to pick yourself up. How are you fixed in preparations for Italy this weekend?
Yeah, as you know yourself, we would have done a hot review, and now we've done our cold reviews, and we've looked at all of the areas. And it's funny, like, your perception of the game changes from immediately afterwards when you do a hot review to, you know, a couple of days later, and you're going around the place like a gremlin for 2 days. Nobody can talk to you. You don't want to see anyone. The sun was shining outside and there was kids laughing and playing, and I was only sure to put out and tell them to get away from my house, go away.
It's so true. You play a match next day, wouldn't you?
Oh, God, yeah. Look, we're doing all right now. We've kind of, you know, we've had a look at it. We're looking at it objectively, and our coaches are helping us to move on to the Italian picture that's going to be presented for us next week, and really, you know, put on a performance that can back up the potential that we showed against Wales. And that can back up our potential and our aim to qualify for a World Cup this year and go and perform at that World Cup. You know, there are budding superstars in this team. That's not, you know, the France performance doesn't take away the potential that's in this squad. Like, look at Stacey Flood coming off the bench. She showed huge spark. And then you've got the girls the week before, Bavin, Dorothy, Emer, everyone. You know, that's all still there. That hasn't disappeared in a week just because we've had one bad team performance. They're all still potential, so we need to remind the nation of the potential of the squad, really, if we are going to get everyone to buy in and rally behind and demand more for this team.
That's for sure, Cliona. And everyone is behind you and wishes you the best. And I think I speak for a lot of people when I say we just love for there to be opportunity for girls and women all over the country to be able to go out and play rugby. Cliona, thanks for joining us. Cliona teamed up with Guinness as part of the Never Settle campaign. Rugby fans will now have the chance to vote on the 2021 Women's Six Nations Player of the Championship, supported by Guinness for the very first time. We are going to take a very quick break.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. Today is a huge day for our Irish swimmers because Swim Ireland's national swim trials are taking place and our swimmers have the opportunity to qualify for several upcoming competitions, including the Tokyo Olympics. John Kenny is there for us. And John, there have been some qualifications today.
Yeah, we got two. Lawrence Daniel Wiffen and Tennessee-based Mona McSherry have dipped under the Olympic qualifying time for the men's 800 freestyle and the women's 100 metres breaststroke, respectively. Now, both of those times were set this morning in the heats. The 20-year-old Wiffen swimming 7 minutes 52.68 seconds in that 800 freestyle, which is now part of the Tokyo Olympic programme, having not been there in the past. He smashed not only Andrew Breeze's 2013 Irish senior record by almost 13 seconds, but it was also under the FINA A consideration time for the Summer Games by over 1.5 seconds. McSherry is the former world junior champion, also set a new Irish record, went under the Olympic qualifying time for her main event, the 100 metres breaststroke, this morning, and she went even faster in the semi-finals this evening, registered a time of 106.29, setting her second Irish record of the day. That time is currently seventh on the current world ranking. She's in terrific form, and is even faster than the current British record, which is saying something. So McSherry and Wiffen now join Shane Ryan and Dara Green, who have already posted times to qualify for the Games in July. They'll go forward for ratification for the Olympic Federation of Ireland, but the Olympic Federation, or the Olympic Council as it was in the past, have never turned down an Irish swimmer who's made a qualifying time. So you can pretty much say that they're on the plane for Tokyo. 95 days out. Let's keep the fingers crossed for that. Green also set a new Irish record in the 100 metres breaststroke. Won his heat this morning. Ryan is through to the men's 100 metres backstroke final tomorrow night. He'll be hoping to bring Conor Ferguson through to a qualifying time in Wednesday night's finals. Bit of a disappointment, though, for two of our swimmers. We thought they would be on the plane today. Brendan Hyland and Jack McMillan in the men's 200 butterfly and 200 metres freestyle, respectively. They won their semi-finals, but they were marginally outside the Olympic qualifying standard, now hoping to go quicker in the final on Wednesday night. There's also a number of Irish Paralympians taking part in the five-day meet here at the NAC. That's qualification for that is a little bit more complicated. Paralympic Games slots are awarded to nations based on the world ranking, so Ireland have secured three female and one male slot so far. Swim Ireland cannot pre-select as swimmers are competing against one another here as well, but it's great to see them competing as well at this Irish national team time trials. We will resume in the morning at 10 o'clock if you'd like to see it live. It's on the RTE player.
We will do. Thanks so much, John Kenny. We're going to take a quick break. But first, anybody who was wondering about the build up to the Chelsea Brighton game, there are some demonstrations out there. And in the middle of them is former Chelsea goalkeeper Petr Cech. And he is remonstrating with fans and he is saying that this has to be sorted out. OK, time for a quick break.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Brendan Devaney's on the line now. The draw for the Ulster Senior Football Championship has just been made. Did it throw up any surprises or any real good clashes, Brendan?
Exciting stuff, I suppose, yeah. From a Donegal perspective, I don't think Declan Bonner would have wanted to be in the preliminary round. I just think with the Division 1 and how everything's going to be crammed in this year, he would have rather just went into the quarter-final phase. But he won't be making any excuses about that, of course. The bigger teams, I suppose, the last 10 years up in the Cavins, historic one last year was bossed by the big three. You know, Monaghan won in two championships, Tyrone 3 and Donegal 5 before last year. So those three big teams have all avoided each other. And that, I suppose, is the story going into this Ulster Championship.
Yeah, they really have. I suppose when you think of the what we were looking forward to last year with Donegal and Tyrone, we were nearly building up to it for such a long time. But this one has kept them apart. But at the same time, as you said, Donegal having that preliminary game before going into a game against Derry, Armagh Antrim, Monaghan Fermanagh and Tyrone Cavan, there's going to be a huge amount of build-up to these games anyway, just because we've had so little action for such a long time. And a lot of the action we have, Brendan, has been of things that have been happening when they shouldn't be happening. And one team that will be interesting to see how well prepared they are Monaghan, who take on Fermanagh.
Yeah, it's certainly exactly. a lot of stuff coming out, Murray. Seems to be rumour mills constantly. But I don't know about you guys, but after the last 4 months, you know, you were going to throw up the head all together with what was happening. So just the fact that we're talking about the league and the draw from the championship, it's still, for me, it's hard to believe because of where we've been, that this is going to be the future. And certainly looking over at my friends across the border and the vaccinated six, I'm going to call them, they are certainly a step ahead of us, Murray. So if anything happens, it's going to happen this side of the border. So they'll be getting ready for that Ulster Championship, knowing that they'll be ready, guns, all guns blazing. There's still a few question marks, I think around the country, around how we're going to get up to that level. But certainly, as you're right, I mean, Tyrone this year, new management, fascinating stuff. I think the draw with Cavan. I mean, who would have seen Cavan win an Ulster last year? And just interesting, Murray, I mean, the winners of Munster and the winners of Ulster are going to be playing in Division 3 this year. It's hard to believe. It's fascinating to see how this will play out. And I think, you know, Armagh and Antrim, Enda McGinley, new management in there as well. So, you know, Monaghan, Fermanagh, with Ulster, there's always interesting battles. There's loads going on. And I know the history books always point to the top three. But I think Cavan has given a lot of hope to teams around the country, and Tipperary as well, you know. So I think that's positive for teams going into this championship.
It really is. Brendan Devaney, thanks so much for joining us. Of course, all of those draws were made over the last couple of days, so if anybody wants to check them out, do go on to rte.ie and all the information will be there. As I mentioned, Chelsea and Brighton is kicking off at 8 o'clock. There are some scenes outside of the ground, but the BBC are now reporting they understand that Chelsea are preparing documentation to request withdrawing from the European Super League. We were talking to Mark Langdon a little bit later on. That's from Dan Rowan, the editor of the BBC, is making reference to this Chelsea news. We were talking to Mark Langdon a little bit earlier, and we were saying that as the days are going by, as the hours are going by, it does seem like the power of the Super League is starting to erode as more and more teams are disassociating themselves with it. We know that Bayern and PSG aren't going to be in it, and it looks like now that Chelsea could be out as well. So I think I know what we're going to be talking about again tomorrow, lads.
Aye. Yeah, I won't be here.